Hi, everybody. I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Karen.
Hi, I'm Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
So up to this point, we have gone through the steps, 1 through 12. Last week was 12. You want to recap them on leaning in? That could be the whole hour if she gets on a roll, but that's okay.
Okay, hold on.
I'm just on a roll.
How many weeks? We have 2 weeks left.
We have this week
and next week. So this week we're going to do two wives and the family afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And next week we're going to do two employees with a vision for you, which I think is a really good kind of mix. Okay, so step one, if you're new, stick around. If you have time, reach into where you really are powerless. And this requires you, almost when you have time, it requires you to do step two before step one, because we've got to connect in with God before we can see the agnosticism and where we're in control. So in step two, if you're new, if you believe that I believe, that's enough to start. If you have time, take a step back and really contemplate the box that you have your current God in and see if you can get it to a bigger box. In the third step, if you're new, make a decision to stick with the sponsor you have and to go through the work. If you have time, stick with the sponsor that you have and go through the work. make a decision, right? Right in the front of your big book that I'm willing to go to any lengths, even if I don't understand what any lengths means, and then sign it and date it and finish the process that you're in, no matter where you are in that process. In inventory, if you're new, Do the process that your sponsor gives you and get through a 4-column inventory, no matter how many columns it actually has. If you have time, I dare you to seek out a new format to a 4-column inventory. There's like 400 of them. And do something different. In 5, if you're new, show up and bear all. And, you know, and when I mean all, I mean all. And if you have time, really start and be prepared when you walk into your fifth step to really try your best to uncover new parts of your agnosticism and your control and your character defects, and be willing to hear some serious new chunks of truth about yourself. In 6, if you're new, make a list of the character defects you find on 4. If you have time, make a list of the character defects you find on 4 and really sit with them. And if you're not willing to completely let them go, root and branch, there's an extra exercise that you can do, which would be benefit versus consequence for each one of those defects that you're not ready to let go of. It can help clear away some of the, you know, the arrogance of letting go and letting God. And then 7, get on your knees and pray if you don't have time. And if you do have time, get on your knees and pray. There's a 7-step prayer in the book. Use it. And stop thinking that you can change something suddenly that you could never change before, and realize that only God can do these things for us. In 8, make a list of people that are on your inventory if you have no time, if this is your first time through. If you have time, make a list of people from your inventory, and write those amends cards. I encourage you to use the 3 questions on the back of each card of, is there any other way that I've harmed you that I'm not aware of? Can you tell me how this process made you feel? And what do I do to set these matters straight? And take them to your sponsor and let her or him go over them and approve them to make sure that you're not going to cause still more damage by making an amends. And in 9, if you've never done this before, take direction from your sponsor and get out there and get it done. And if you've been through this process before, get with your sponsor, do what you're told, and get out there and get it done. In 10, if you've never been through this process, any moment out in the world where you feel like jammed or pissed off or arrogant, or you feel like pause. Ask God to get involved and to remove that from you, and then call your sponsor or somebody in your network. If you have time, do the same thing. In 11, if you've never been through this process, go to your sponsor and discuss how to do 11-step inventory every night and every morning, and start that practice. I can tell you that if you do that on a very regular basis, it will keep you from doing lengthy inventory as often. If you have time, get back to your 11th step, because God knows I've never met anybody that hasn't just like let it drift away for a while. And really use that time. I can tell you in the 11th step where it says, did I pack into the stream of life? There's a part in there. What that means to me today with the amount of time I have is, did I feel spiritually moved today and actually take action on that nudge from God? Or did I swallow it for whatever reason, out of fear, arrogance, whatever? And in 12, sponsor others. If you've never been through this process before and you get to 12, get a sponsee and screw it up as much as you can. Because it will just prove to you, I screw everything up, so it will prove to you that you're not in charge and that you're not in charge of your sponsee's recovery and that it really was God the whole time and your job is just to dole out the instructions, however screwed up they may be. And if you have time, do the same thing. Screw up some more. Make some more mistakes. The only thing that I know with the first half of 12 is that if you haven't done it, you can't tell somebody to do it. But if you feel spiritually moved to tell somebody to do something you've never done before, do it with them. You know, if you feel spiritually moved to tell somebody to, like, I don't know, open doors for 5 people at random places in public every day, and you feel spiritually moved, like you really feel like this is coming through you, and you've never done that before, you do it too, because it's not a bad thing. And the second half of the 12th step is practice, 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 practice. I will never be perfect. I hope to never be perfect, because every time I grow, I feel like I've been relaunched into the fourth dimension, and it's the most amazing experience of my life. So my consistent prayer is, show me where I can grow today. I'm still a junkie, so I still want to feel that like rocketed feeling. And the only way we can get there is by growth, is by hard growth. Sometimes not hard. Usually for me it's hard because, I don't know, I'm agnostic and I'm kind of a douche. But which brings us to the forgotten chapters. The forgotten chapters are all about the second half of the 12th step. These chapters are packed with principles on how to practice these principles in all of our affairs. The first one goes to the wives. Today, the way that I look at this is a great chapter. If you're having a hard time in writing your amends cards in your 9th step, read this chapter out loud to yourself or have somebody read it out loud to you, because you will definitely have a better understanding of how you've affected the people around you if you read this step, this chapter. The other thing I want to say, and this is my opinion, as
Beth's opinion.
That's Beth's opinion, which means nothing to anybody else but me.
And obviously me.
And apparently you. I don't believe that it is responsible for alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous to go to Al-Anon. I think that we've taken enough of other people's safe spaces away from them. My experience is that I had a big book sponsor who told me that sobriety is all about relationships. And as we've said a million times, first I get a relationship with God, then I get a relationship with me, and step 9, they let me out of the house to start having relationships with other people. My relationship to God, my relationship to the things in my life, my relationship to the principles in society, my relationship with, what do I think about marriage, what do I think about education, what do I think about politics? These are all things that I get to have a relationship with. Some I have a deeper relationship with, some I have a more shallow relationship with. You choose. You have deeper relationships with anything and everything in this world that you choose to. All of those principles on how to do that can be taken from this book. I believe that, and this again is my opinion, and my experience is that alcoholics need to be selfless and Al-Anons need to be selfish. We work towards the same goal of balance from completely different ends of the spectrum. And I have experience going into an Al-Anon meeting and getting the direct opposite direction from that fellowship that will save my life. You know, we look at sick. I mean, if you really look at an active sick relationship that involves an alcoholic, it usually involves an Al-Anon, for lack of a better word, which is like a normal nice person. And basically what happens is the alcoholic makes it all about them, and the Al-Anon makes it all about the alcoholic, and then it's all about the alcoholic. And the only way to experience freedom is in balance. And if I go to a fellowship that continuously promotes putting myself back into the center of my own life, I will drink eventually. I have never had, I was like a paperboard, I was like a cardboard version of Beth Balaban or Beth Bonadonna at the time when I got sober. I didn't know how to have relationships. I didn't know how to, I couldn't keep a job for more than like 3 to 4 months before I got fired because it was like, oh, you want to have a conversation with me? Screw you, I quit. You want to know my favorite color? Whoa, this is getting too deep, I'm out. And so everything that I've learned about relationships, I've learned from this book and multiple other sources within the community and within the world, different books, different shows. I love to watch TV shows. I watch, I actually studied sociology to understand culture because I was like folkways and moral, all that kind of stuff. Like, I still don't understand why we decorate for holidays. Like, it makes no sense in my mind. Like, now I do it because my daughter like really, really likes it. But like, I don't know. Like, sometimes I think I should be a Jehovah's Witness because I'm all like, do we have to celebrate everything? And why does everything cost so much money? And it's stupid. But apparently that's a seriously minority view in our culture. But everything I learned about relationships, I learned from this book. And a lot of the principles that have kept my marriage not dead, I wouldn't say alive always, but not dead, for 18 years is in this book. Having children, I learned how to be a parent from this book. I relearned how to be a parent in this book. And in my latest spiritual adventure, I learned how to not be agnostic in my career, which has been the number one issue out of all the seven circles would be my career and agnosticism in my career, not understanding that, like, oh, this is a thing that you do. Why would God come into it? Like, I couldn't break that barrier. I broke that barrier over the last 2 years from this book. And it's interesting because my friend Anne Marie, we're like polar opposites of each other. We've been friends for like 20-something years, polar opposites of each other, both through the book. Her career is her best circle. And so hearing her do two employers is like amazing. If you ever, she lives here in Westfield. If you ever get the chance to talk to her, have her go through two employers for you because we just did a couple weeks ago. Holy crap. Like, I was just like taking notes. I was just like, I'm not going to do that shit. We're going to jump into these two chapters. I'm not going to read a lot from Two Wives. I think we're going to spend more time in the family afterward. Two Wives is best suited, again, if you need to do 9-step amends and you need to know how you affected the people around you, read this chapter out loud or have somebody read it out loud to you. And I say that because I'm an auditory learner. So if you're an intellectual learner, then read it to yourself in your head. I can't do that. So,
and it's a humbling chapter to really get a view of what we bring into the home and what the destruction that we do. And, you know, when I was drinking, of course, I couldn't see all of that. And then I get sober and start going through the book with Beth, and I couldn't understand why every time, here was a perfect example in my life, was that doing the sheets. I'd always ask Fred to help me fold the sheets when they come out of the dryer. Well, I can't do he can't do corners, and I really can't do them either, but I guess I pretended I could. And I would get so upset that he didn't do the fitted sheet right in the corner. You remember this whole thing. And I would do like a meltdown. I mean, I don't know what. It was like the beast was alive and well in our house. And every week it would be some kind of episode when we would go to do the fitted sheets. Well, of course, I think it's the fitted sheets' fault. It's not me or my program. But it was a great example of watching him, now that I'm sober, of what I had done to his life. Like, he would see the beast come out and just how he would just pull back. And because of my behavior on just trying to fold these sheets, he would withdraw almost into the closet because there I was clean and sober, acting like a maniac. I mean, I went to Beth's house, and I'm like, you got to show me how to do fitted sheets. I mean, this is a real problem in my life. And she did. She was sending me videos. We were trying to, she showed me how to do the sheets. I just thought I would get sober, and I would be like, oh, I bring all this, like, serenity into our house, and I was like a maniac. I mean, I put more holes in the walls when I was, once I got sober, than when I was drinking, because I had relief when I was drinking. I mean, I was, you know, having a good time, but when I got sober, and life wasn't going the way that I wanted. But that reaction of the family around me, to watch them when the beast comes in at, once you're sober, and to watch the character defects they've had to cloak themselves with to protect themselves from what we brought into the house on a daily basis, was really kind of terrifying and heartbreaking. Yeah. So now we do still fold sheets, but we laugh because we still can't do the corners. And we've made a joke of it, so I have survived that. And I still can't do it like you showed me how to do it.
I did fold the sheets today.
Oh, you're so
I got one more load at home. I told every time I fold sheets now, I think of Karen. But that's the deal. It's about folding sheets. I know it sounds like too small and stupid. Every single person in this room would be just fine if we lived alone. We'd be just fine because the sheets would either be rolled up in a ball, thrown in a corner, or folded perfectly, or we send them out and let somebody else fold the sheets. But these little things, there's about probably 1,000 of them a day that enter our home. And the either I'm going to match calamity with serenity, which requires me to have a connection with my God, or the beast is going to come out. And here's the thing, too. Like, we make amends to people, especially the intimate relationships that we have, our parents, our children, our BFFs. I had a friend hasn't even made amends yet, but she was out of my life for a while, and now she's back in my life, and I've got her here. I'm not going to allow myself to go into that realm with that human being again until I'm sure it's safe. And that's how people are with us. Dude, it took my dad 8 years to drop his walls, to drop his guard, and to be who he is, actually genuinely himself in front of me. 8 years of showing up on a consistent basis, trying my best, and I don't think I ever succeeded, but trying my best to be the daughter that he deserved. 8 years it took him to drop his guard.
To feel safe.
To feel safe in front of me. Because the reality is that we're alcoholics, right? We're just like every other human being, but it's like on steroids, right? So like normal human beings have ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs. And you want to know that the number one misdiagnosed thing for alcoholism is bipolar. Used to be called manic depression, because our ups and downs are like this. And then we decide to not do our 11th step for a couple of weeks, or we cop a resentment that puts us in a really dark place, and then all of a sudden we're just, the beast is out all day, every day. And I can't stress enough that if you don't think that your beast has ever reared its ugly head at work or at home or with your loved ones, then you're probably pretty agnostic about it. We don't have bad days, we have beast days. Or bad moments. We don't have bad moments, we have beast moments. Because we don't do gray well. So we're either like the best person in the room or the worst person in the room until we start to have
balance,
right? So until we start to work towards balance, we're just either a beaming, lovely example of the
loving
walking
the
big book, or raging like cyclone, like on fire and hail at the same time, because that's not possible in any other world than alcoholism. We're a dichotomy. They're, one of our greatest gifts when we do get into balance is that you can give us any issue and we can see both sides of it. On our worst days, we are both sides of it, which means no one can ever win. It's so true, right? It just goes right into you, and you're just like, oh, yeah, those walls look mustard to you? No, they're red. Oh, they're red? No, they're mustard. You lose.
But I just agreed with you. No, you didn't. So, the other really great thing about two wives is that if you have somebody that you're doing the first step process with, one of the first things that we need to do with somebody that walks into these rooms, and I've actually done it multiple times in recovery, not every time I've been through the work, but multiple times, is on the bottom of page 108 through 110, it goes through the four stages of drinkers. So if you have somebody that needs to figure out whether they're alcoholic or not, this is a really great tool to start reading through and asking questions, right? So kind of do like the golden slippers format where you take each statement and you turn it into a question for your sponsee or for yourself and ask yourself these questions to find out if they're actually alcoholic. Because I have to tell you something. I have a very close friend of mine who was sober for 14, 16 years or something like that and realized she wasn't an alcoholic. She's been drinking for, I think, almost like a year and a half, 2 years now. Totally normal. She wasted... Well, I don't think it's a waste. Well, there's a little bit of envy, but not really. But she spent all of these years seeking the truth while living a lie. And why would you want to submit yourself? I mean, yes, there's multiple lessons in here for every human being on the face of the earth, but she never really felt like she fit in 100% for that many years. Because she never did a thorough first step process. Do the first step process. And, you know, it's dangerous to say that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the reality is that if you're not 100% conceding to your innermost self that you're alcoholic, then you can't completely abandon yourself to God. If you are afraid to pull that screen back to find out if you're alcoholic or not, then you don't have the desperation of a dying man. And I probably know a lot of people that would really want to slap me in the face for saying that, but that's the truth. Yeah. Be who you are. God has your back, I promise.
And I so wanted to be her friend when I met her, like, maybe it's just not as bad as I think, or I don't, but, you know, doing a thorough first step, you know, doing the powerlessness and unmanageability, I was in category four right out of, and I mean, you may have a husband of whom you completely despair, he's been placed in one institution after another, he is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk, sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital, perhaps he has the delirium tremors, doctors may shake their head and advise you to have him committed. They told my parents to put me away and lock me up and throw away the key. Maybe you've already been obliged to put him away. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they got well. I mean, I was there, so I, you know, couldn't deny that one. That's on page 110. And like Beth said, in those following pages, it goes through the different categories of where someone might be. And I just want to share with you on... it's amazing to me how many different ways I went instead before I could get to the place where I surrendered to this program and really did the work. I went to Al-Anon because I worked in the drug addiction field. So, I must belong in Al-Anon. And I'm sure somewhere along the way somebody suggested it, you know, and I didn't hear the things that, you know, 90% of the people were saying. I would take the one thing that, you know, was kind of off key or whatever. Anyway, so I show up at Al-Anon, and don't get me wrong, I love Al-Anon, saved my mother and father's lives. I'm not sure, I'm so grateful for Al-Anon because my mom and dad found a really safe place to go. When they needed it. But there I was in Al-Anon. It's with my guy. We had children that we were having trouble with. And it was all about take care of yourself. I mean, because for years, you know, the family members are all focused on us. And they were telling me how to be, I don't know if you want to use the word selfish, but self-care and self-respect and self-love. And for me, that was be selfish, because I hear things through a different, you know, I see things through a different pair of glasses. So, and then I was telling everybody that I was in recovery. I'm not sure that was the right place to do that either, but I love to throw that out there. And then I would get, oh, that's so awesome that you came, and that's so good you're here. And it, like, became all about me, and I loved that because that just, but what that did was it fed the sick part of me instead of the healthy part of me, because I was coming from the selfish part, and then I heard be selfish, and I was like, ding, 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 this is perfect for me. So I got unhealthy instead of getting healthy. And I can remember when Beth said, everything you need is in this book, and, you know, after it talks about in here the four different stages or the different kinds of alcoholism. It goes on about healthy relationships. It starts on 111. And I have not, now this is, you know, where I'm at now, my recovery, found anything yet that there hasn't been an answer in this book. I just wasn't willing to look and put it to practice. Do you want to talk about the healthy relationships that it talks?
You can.
On the top of page 111, and these are great principles for any healthy relationship. The first one is, the first principle of success is that you should never be angry. Okay, maybe easier said than done, but this is where you can use your God to come in. You know, things done in anger never usually work out well. So that's one principle. The next paragraph is, our next thought is that you should never tell him what he must do about his drinking, or anything. You know, you should. You know, there's an Al-Anon statement, don't shit on me and I won't shit on you. My mom was a good Al-Anoner.
Your mom was a rock star.
Yeah, she was. So not doing the shoulds, not telling somebody else what they should do. Down in the next paragraph, it says, do not set your heart on reforming anybody. It says your husband. It's talking about not reforming. And then it says, attempt instead to put yourself in his place. Let him see what you want to be rather than help, to be helpful rather than critical. You can bring this into any relationship in your life. Arguments. They're going to happen unless you live in some kind of glass house that I'm not sure of. And I think this is something that you taught me. I don't really know. I think so. In an argument, you shouldn't bring up anything that's past 90 days.
Oh, yeah, that's in the family afterward. I'll go over that.
Oh, okay. Yep. All right, I'm jumping ahead.
That's okay.
Okay, all right. Well, that's part of a healthy relationship.
Yep.
Do you want to describe that a little bit, or do you want to wait?
I'll wait.
Okay, all right. So, anyway, I just wanted to bring up those four principles on, and any time you hit a wall with the person that you're with, it's always good to step back, take a look at it, and you can go through this on how healthy do you want it to be. You know, are you bringing something to it, or are you taking something from it? Are you part of the problem, or are you part of the solution?
Yeah? Mm-hmm. You want to head into family afterward?
There's just one other thing that was really kind of perfect for today. At the bottom of 110, at the very bottom, it says, we know all about liquor as a social lubricant. Some, but not all of us, think it has its advantages when reasonably used. Somewhere along the line, someone had said that it can be the same for gossip. Okay? We know all about liquor as a social lubricant. And I've shared with you guys several times in here how I work with all women. And it's just this whole, everybody just gossips. And, like, nobody knows anything about anybody's private life. So the only thing they talk about when they come to work is each other. And it's been very hard for me to feel connected to the women that I work with and not be part of this gossip. And so I wasn't gossiping. What I was doing was I was just standing there listening. Well, I thought I'm not part of the problem, but what I also wasn't was part of the solution. So, of course, there's all these, you know, fights going on, and I mean, it's 10 women, and our boss is a man, the poor guy. And he says to me today, he says, you know, it's like poison in here with everybody talking about everybody. He said, I really need you to stop and not being gay, I don't know what word he said, but not have anything to do with that. It has to stop. And of course, I think I'm the only one he's saying this to. It's all about me. It's my problem. And he, I walk away and it's fuming and I get along with everybody at work. I'm getting up this fight. I'm going to go tell him, do you have a problem with me? Is there something that I did? And, thank God for this program, because, I did. I leaned in. I said to God, what is it that you want me to learn here? What is it that you want me to hear here? And in asking, it's just like, just be part of the solution. Don't be part of the problem. And sitting there and listening can be just as much. So I said to my boss the next time that things slowed down, and I said to him, I will no longer be part of the problem. I will do my best to be part of the solution. And he looked at me and he said, thanks. Like, wow. Obviously, I don't normally behave that way. Because he was as surprised as maybe I was. And I did hear him. He did tell every other woman in the place. There's just a great example of leaning in instead of leaning out.
And I can tell you, if you encounter somebody that's gossiping and you don't want to gossip, it's immediately, you're uncomfortable. It's the most uncomfortable thing in the entire world, especially if you know who they're talking about. I have the perfect statement that you say to somebody that's gossiping and you disagree because you just don't want to be a part of judgment and labeling. I usually look up somebody, I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I don't experience them that way. Done. It will squelch gossip in a hot second. I'm really sorry. I don't experience her that way. And it just lets them know it's not shaming. I got so shamed at the groomer yesterday. Oh my God, it was awful. I haven't been shamed in years. I literally was like, shamed. And we all work really hard at not shaming people. I don't know why I'd share that. But it's not shaming. It's not a put down. You're not telling them what to do. You're not judging them. You're just simply saying, no, not here.
That's interesting you say that, because you've said that to me. Obviously, I've wanted to gossip with you because you've said that to me a lot. I can hear you saying that in my head, and it stopped me in my tracks. That's really interesting.
I'm not experiencing that way.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's hard. Okay, so if you've been in AA for a couple of years, like you all have the same friends, right? And Joe is annoying. Everybody knows Joe is annoying. Joe's the most annoying human being on the face of the earth. But Sally comes to you and says, Joe is annoying, and you know Joe is annoying. You're not helping Sally by going, yeah, he's totally annoying. The best thing you can do is, why do you find him annoying? What is it about you that his whatever sticks with you long after he's gone? If you want to come to me and you want to tell me Joe's annoying, you had better be prepared to look at your part so that Joe's not so annoying to you anymore. That is how I deal with anybody that gossips to me about anybody else. Because I don't think that most people mean to gossip. It's the difference between relief and recovery. When you come to me and you're like, oh God, Joe, so annoying, you're looking for relief. I no longer condone people in my life who only seek relief, because I do not seek relief. Usually I seek recovery. Because if I vent to you about Joe, I'm going to feel better for a day. But now I've put it on you. And in a day, I'm going to need to put it on somebody else. Or I'm going to put it on you again. And then all of a sudden, I start using you as my deposit for annoying Joe stuff. Because I keep getting relief, but it keeps wearing off. It's the same as the substances we used. Don't think that just because alcohol is out of your body, you're not alcoholic. Now you're using venting as your alcohol. It gives you a little bit of relief, but then you need to keep doing it in order to get that relief. It's much better if we stop each other and be of service to each other and say, so you've said to me now 3 days in a row that Joe's annoying. What is it about you that can't let Joe be who he is? Why does it bother you so much? And turn it back onto the person that needs to vent and help them get through it so that they never have to do this again. It's important. Okay, on page 115, it talks about, what is this? Oh, when you have carefully explained to such a person that he is a sick person, you will be created a new atmosphere. Barriers that have sprung up between you and your friends will disappear the group. Okay, this is talking about making excuses for other people. So, Dan did not pay the dental bill. I hope he never listens to this. He can listen to it. I don't care. So the dentist's bill is in my name, but he insists on paying the bills. So I get a call from a lawyer on Long Island saying, Beth Balaban, this is Joe Schmo, and you need to call me your first convenience. It's very important. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, somebody needs to go to rehab. I'll call him back. And so I call him back, and he's like, he threatened me on the phone. He's like, I just want to let you know that you have a $1,700 bill, and with incurred legal fees, it'll be a minimum of $2,700. And I said, can I have my husband call you back? Because I'm not responsible for paying that bill. And I called my husband, I forwarded him the voicemail, and I called him, and I said, I just got a threatening phone call from somebody saying that they're going to take me to court over $1,700. You told me 3 months ago that you were going to pay this bill. You did not. You need to take care of it. And I don't like being threatened on the phone for your stuff. Oh, yeah, flowers. Flowers. When I say I got flowers, I actually got coffee, but we all know what flowers mean.
Yeah.
We don't make excuses for anybody anymore, right? The Al-Anons, we need to stop expecting anybody to lie for us, to do things for us, to cover for us, because it's not sober behavior, right? And so it says here, you will no longer be self-conscious or feel that you must apologize as though your husband were of weak character. He may be anything but that. Your new courage, good nature, and lack of self-consciousness will do wonders for you socially. The same principle applies when dealing with children. Unless they actually need protection from their father, it is best not to take sides in an argument he has with them while drinking. Or any other time. Use your energies to promote a better understanding all around. Then, that terrible tension which grips the home of every problem drinker will be lessened. And I can tell you, so this actually carried through to my in-laws coming to me shortly. We were engaged shortly before we were married, so it's like a million years ago. And my husband was going through some stuff. And my mother, I'll never forget this, my mother-in-law came to me in the driveway right before I left. Dan had already left and stopped me in the driveway and cornered me and said, what's going on with Dan? You need to tell me what's going on with Dan. And I said to her, if you want to know what's going on with Dan, you need to have a conversation with Dan. I will not get in the middle of my relationship or your relationship with any other human being on the face of the earth. If one of my sponsees calls me and asks me what's going on with another sponsee, my first reaction is, did you speak with them? If I think that Karen needs to have a conversation with Becca because maybe Becca's going through something, I will text Karen and go, hey, I really think you should give Becca a call this week. It would probably be a really good idea. That's it. I stay out of other people's relationships, and I can tell you that I'm teaching my 11-year-old daughter that now, literally right now, for whatever godforsaken reason, she's decided to be BFFs with Kate and Marina, who are lovely girls, but their fathers grew up together, they were born together, they've been BFFs since birth, and now all of a sudden Morgan's number three, and they got in a fight about Morgan's party being canceled on Friday and the whole thing, and then all of a sudden one of the moms is on the phone, and I'm all sorts of, what the? And I'm staying out of it, but I consistently give her that message that you don't get in between Kate and Marina. If Kate and Marina have a problem and they come to you, you tell them to go to each other, because you will lose. Always will lose, and I'm watching her do this. These principles come out of the big book.
And, you know, And I think this chapter really hits it, too. I mean, all the damage that we've done to the family. A good example in my life was when my mother died. My children called Fred and said, "Is Mom okay?" It, meaning me. "Is, you know, is my mom okay?" And I didn't realize, like, he's learning along with me, but he said, "Call her and ask her." But see, that was the dynamic of what it was. When I was a mess and I'm out there getting it done, everything, they're calling him to see if I'm okay. Nobody's coming to me. So they could pick up the phone and they could ask, "Are you okay?" And my kids even did ask me, "Do you feel like drinking?" Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that knee-jerk reaction is, "How dare you ask me? Haven't I learned any trust? What makes you..." And just say, "No, I don't feel like drinking." And that, you know, and if you want to ask me tomorrow, as I can tell you, I'm not going to drink today. If you want to ask me again tomorrow, you can ask me again tomorrow. Because for others to get safe too, it takes time. I mean, I drank for a lot of years. They learned a lot of ways to protect themselves and to get unhealthy. I mean, it takes a long time for all of us to heal. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it says that repeatedly in these chapters, in the forgotten chapters. So, like, even in Two Wives, it says... Hold on. This is... I don't have a book that's, like, got all notes through it anymore because I lost it. But it says father knows he is to blame, or is that we're going to go? All right, we're going to go into the family afterwards, because we only have 10 minutes. Dude, it takes me an hour to take my girls through this chapter, but we can do it in 10 minutes. Okay,
so chapter 9, 122.
Yep. So down on the bottom, I'm just going to do the highlighted parts that I have in here from the last time I did this. But it says the entire family is to some extent ill. Let families realize, as they start their journey, that all will not be fair weather. Each in his turn may be footsore and may straggle. This is really, really important for me in my current stage of recovery, because I have a 13-year-old who's learning a lot. He's incredibly bright. He's gifted in math, and we all get 100%. He got like 90% in math and like 10% in every other area of life. Like every other area. So he's like a little slow to the game with a lot of other stuff. And it's interesting because I have to give him time to practice. I have to look at him, because I've been in AA for so long, everything in my mind works through AA language, but I have to see him like a newcomer. So we have this whole thing for, like, I think we're on day, like, 18 or something like that. But it's, like, we're doing a new, it takes 90 days to create a habit, which, by the way, that's where the term 90 and 90 came from. It was the industry's way to manipulate alcoholics to just get addicted to going to meetings. So they said, anyway, so it takes 90 days to form a habit. So we have this process that we do every night before we go to bed. We put all the laundry in the right containers. We make sure that everything is put away. We brush our teeth. We wash our hair. We go to bed. We make sure everything is where it belongs for the next morning. And he's doing a really good job until one night that he doesn't. And then in my alcoholic mind, "You never do this right. Come on, get upstairs. Oh, my God. It's 9 o'clock. We're supposed to start a half hour ago." Because I'm a lunatic. And he's looking at me. And what I'm realizing is that I'm negating the last 17 days that he did it all perfectly. Or I had to remind him once to brush his teeth. But you know what I mean? Like, we have to treat people, especially the ones that we live in, as we start to grow into new parts of ourselves, we have to let the rest of the other people catch up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's the same concept of, "I just made my amends, why the hell aren't you forgiving me?" It's that I want it now. I want it in my time. And here, we all have to, it says it over and over throughout these chapters, that this stuff's going to take time. And on 123, I've highlighted, "But the head of the household has spent years pulling down the structures of business, romance, friendship, health. These things are now ruined or damaged. It will take time to clear away the wreck. Though old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones, the new structures will take years to complete." Years. So if you have been, you know, through the work and, like, you know, it's been 6-9 months, like, everybody take a step back and give yourself a breather and take a pause and realize that this is probably the longest length of time that you've been healthy, and that it's going to take a little bit longer for everybody around us to catch up. On 124, it says, Henry Ford once made a wise remark of the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them to assets. I do not have a sponsor. Well, I have two sponsors. I have my sponsor that took me through the work a million years ago. She will always be my sponsor, even when she's dead. She's still going to be my sponsor. We're going to get seances and stuff going, but I also have an in-town sponsor. My sponsor retired and moved to New Hampshire, but I have an in-town sponsor. She has 13 years. I have more than double her time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she has so much to offer me because she's been working on certain areas in her life that I have not. And these are the areas that I currently need growth in. And so I take my current issues to her on a day-to-day, well, week-to-week basis, and she helps me grow in areas that I have not. Time is only relative if you've spent it actually doing something with it. I do not want to be like that guy who's got 40 years sober and sits in the same seat since the day he got sober. Every Friday, he goes to the 8 o'clock meeting. And if a newcomer sits in his seat, he blows a gasket, his face turns all red. We all know this guy, right? Every freaking home group has this guy. That guy could have 40 years. He's got nothing to offer me. Because he hasn't spent his time leaning in. He's spent his time making sure that he didn't drink and he sat in the same chair at his home group every single week. That's not who I want to be. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. It is possible to dig up past misdeeds and they become a blight or a variable plague. And it goes on to talk about how we bring things up from the past. So it's the same concept as, you know, Ben did something great for 18 days in a row and on the 19th day he didn't do it. And so I blow a gasket and treat him like he's the worst kid in the face of the earth. What am I doing to his ambition to please me? Not anything good. In our house, we have a rule that nothing gets brought up for more than 90 days. So, you know, it keeps us from being fatalistic. You never clean the sink out. You always leave your socks on the floor. You never take the dog for a walk, right? We all do it. We're pissed off in the moment, and because we're alcoholic, we attach the entire history of the world.
You've always been this way.
You've always been this way. You never change. And what I realized was that when my marriage fell apart 8 years ago or something like that, it was 2012, maybe, I don't know, whatever. When my marriage fell apart, one of the things that my husband brought up in therapy was that he felt like it didn't matter what he did. I never saw him in his current moment. And that I always attached every mistake he's ever done to the present moment. And what it did was it emasculated him and completely made him void of ambition of any shift or change because he was just going to keep getting the same shit from me for the rest of his life. So why change? And it brought us to a place that we cannot bring up anything. So the biggest four-letter words in our house are never and always. Those words come out of your mouth, everybody comes to a halt. Because it's like, well, that's not true. That's a lie. And I've actually had my son tell me that that's a lie when I'm yelling at him. You lie. No, I don't. You said always. No, there's no such thing as always or never. You know, this is going to get me off.
Where can somebody change in that? I mean,
you can't. Yeah. You can't exist in that. You can't. So we think that unless some good or useful purpose can be served, past occurrences should not be discussed, right? We give ourselves a 90-day grace period, and it's actually really funny now because, like, Dan, like, left the TV on, like, all night, and I woke up at 4:30 in the morning yesterday. And so, like, I was up at 4:30, and then, like, he got up at, like, 8 or some shit like that. And I was pretty, like, you know, pissed off because it was my one day to sleep in this week. And I was like, well, I'm just letting you know that I'm going to give you flack for the next 90 days. He goes, why? I'm like, because Avengers was still on at 4:30 in the morning when I've been up since. And so, like, he had to get me coffee. He had to go pick up the bagels. I mean, I'm milking this one for 90 days. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we share, and we are sure he would approve. We find it better when possible to stick to our own stories. We talk about each other all the time. I talk about Karen all the time. I talk about Becca all the time. I talk about my husband incessantly. People are like, eh. But I would never, ever say anything that they don't know, that they haven't shared publicly themselves. We are a very tight-knit, incestuous group of people.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you that every single person in this room knows at least 5 people that I know in AA. That makes this very, very difficult because the primary purpose of talking to each other is to process out our issues and get to a bigger level and to grow. And so I'm going to have to tell somebody that Joe is the most annoying person. Oh, my God, I hope Joe never listens to this. I don't know who Joe is, but Joe is the most annoying person in the world. If I say that to you, it is your responsibility to never repeat that I said that to you to any other person in the world, because this can kill people.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody went to everybody and said, Joe's super annoying, and then everybody told everybody else that Joe is super annoying, even if nobody tells Joe that Joe is super annoying, which, by the way, I would totally do. I'd be like, you're annoying. Joe would walk into every single room and feel it. He is annoying. He's totally annoying. He's the most annoying human being on the face of the earth. And then he'd stop coming.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when we just stop coming?
Die.
That's best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Suffer.
Yeah. Pain. Isolation, the beast, and we get to take responsibility for that. And not just for Joe, but for Joe's wife and Joe's kids, Joe's parents, Joe's coworkers, Joe's friends. Everybody in Joe's life is now going to feel the ripple effect of us. This is why we don't talk about other people in AA unless it's with the explicit reason of finding my part and getting myself better. I can't tell you, I've been here for what feels like most of my life. More than half of my life I've spent in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. This needs to be a safe place. I've been to funerals. One of my sisters in this program committed suicide because she couldn't find a place. She couldn't get safe. She moved out to Texas for a job and she couldn't get safe. And so she killed herself. Well, first she drank, and then she killed herself.
Mm-hmm.
We have an immense, and then I'll shut up. We have an immense responsibility in these rooms to each other.
Mm-hmm.
If we do nothing else but in this world but create a safe space in these rooms, we're all going to win. Because this is the place that I want every single one of us to bring the worst version of ourselves. Bring your rage here. Not to your kids, not to your job, and not at the bank. You will probably get arrested. Bring it here. Bring your suicidality here. Bring your depression here. Bring your beast here. Bring your gossip here. And you know what? I dare you. Raise your hand at the next open topic discussion meeting and say, I gossip and I need help. I need people to share their experience, strength, and hope on how they stopped gossiping. Because that's the only way I'm going to stop gossiping. My name's Beth. I'm an alcoholic. And I really hate people. I need somebody to share their experience, strength, and hope in this meeting about how they suffer through this world when most people are so dumb as a box of rocks. Oh my God, my sponsor would have a field day with that statement. That's what we should be bringing here. This should be a safe environment for every single person to bring the worst parts of themselves so that it can grow. so that we can go out there and be the best version of ourselves. And as we bring the worst parts of us here and those parts get better, the best version of ourselves gets better.
Right.
And bigger. And more attractive. And I can tell you, you will get the raise at work. You will get the promotion. You will get the person of your dreams. You'll have the life of your dreams. Because you'll be authentic. I'm going to stop. I'm over-talked.
That's a good place to stop.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
I'll stop talking. Okay. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, guys.